Welcome today to Interview Series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Rick Cooper, top-ranking internationally known entrepreneur, innovator, executive, and investor. Rick, you bring a substantial history of significant and considerable contribution to executive leadership innovation to this interview. We are indeed fortunate to have you share your many deep experiences with the audience. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be talking with you today. Hopefully we can provide your audience with some valuable insights.
You know, Rick, I was just looking at your background, and it's just really amazing. You've done an awful lot worldwide, and you've had an historical impact. Now, due to your recognized international standing as this leading executive entrepreneur and investment expert with deep knowledge of innovation, you were invited to a series of international summits hosted in China, and it was a real pleasure to talk with you while you were in China. So again, congratulations on your many remarkable contributions internationally.
Oh, well, thank you very much for your kind words, Stephen. Yeah, I really enjoyed our trip to China. I've been there several times over the last 5 or 6 years. I think it's fairly well known around the world that the pace of change there is quite remarkable, and the growth rates in various industries are amazing. It's always fun to be there firsthand and experience it. But maybe equally important for me is getting into the countryside and meeting some of the people and learning more about their culture. It's a fascinating country with a very rich history and culture, of course.
Kind of a natural segue into this whole idea of what Great Idea Business Resources did, and they were the sort of the organizers and coordinators of all the kind of summits that occurred in China and the high-tech industry tours. I thought they did a really good job, and this was all sort of funded by various Chinese governments. So what are some of the top lessons that you want to share as being part of this special VIP delegation to China hosted by the government and coordinated by the Great Idea Business Resources Company?
Well, first of all, I'd like to share your opinion that the organizers just did a remarkable job. It was a great event. And then I would say my background mostly, of course, is in the clean tech space. So I've been there several times, and I've seen various battery companies growing quickly and wind and solar growing very quickly there. But I have to say, I was literally blown away by the pace of growth in the ITO and BPO space. Now, we met with numerous executives and government officials in several different cities, and it was more or less unanimous that those stakeholders were all talking about growth rates in this space that ranged anywhere from 20 to 60% on an annual basis. Just really amazing stuff. And then I guess secondly, I would say that it was quite interesting to learn that even though they have this enormous population in China, that the same executives and government officials all had the same feedback for their number one challenge in these businesses was hiring people fast enough. So I thought that was an interesting kind of contrast there. They're known for this huge population, but some of these fields are growing so fast they have a hard time finding people. Maybe another lesson would be the extent of the support that government agencies provide for these startup companies. We toured a number of incubator facilities that provided all kinds of great space and equipment for these early stage companies at little or no cost in the very beginning stages of the company. They have generous relocation packages to bring scientists from other parts of China to the regions that they're developing these technology centers in. And they even contribute to some of the personnel costs in the early days. And of course, they have tax breaks. So there's a sort of remarkable support infrastructure from the agencies there for these startup companies. Another lesson I would have to say was the just how modern and well equipped their facilities are. I would say that clearly exceeded my expectations. Frankly speaking, I saw several places where I felt like I was literally in Silicon Valley. You couldn't tell the difference, and it was it's very impressive just how well equipped these modern facilities are. And then from a more personal, interesting perspective, it was fascinating to be out in the rural areas for the first time. I've been to China several times, usually just fly into the big cities and fly out for various business meetings. So traveling around in this delegation by bus between the different cities gave us a great chance to see how things are developing in the countryside, and that again was exceeding my expectations. They have world-class freeways, high-speed rail and the electrical distribution system is truly something else. And even down to the working level, the typical house that people live in the countryside really exceeded my expectations. They're, you know, modern concrete structures, satellite television, air conditioning. Yeah, it was a real treat to be involved with that, and I certainly took away a number of valuable lessons.
As I mentioned, you have this sort of very remarkable background, and maybe we can drill down further into that. What triggered your initial interest in science and technology, and then what forces shaped your interest?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Stephen. That takes me back a long way, actually. As a small boy, I can remember being very curious and really wondering how things worked. And I think rather than playing with puzzles or games, I was always kind of busy taking things apart and trying to learn how they worked. One example, I remember completely disassembling the lawnmower. Literally every single bolt and every single component was taken apart and spread all over the garage floor. Fortunately, I was able to put it back together, and as a result, I guess my dad became fairly supportive of that hobby. He would go to various garages and airport hangars and ask the mechanics for broken gizmos that he could bring home for me to play with. So I guess in summary, I'd say that I was naturally curious, and I was fortunate to have grown up in a very supportive and thoughtful environment.
Well, it's interesting that from there you went and graduated first in your class from the British Columbia Institute of Technology, and then again you were top ranked in your class when you got your degree at Cal Poly State University. So this is just a remarkable educational background. And then going on to, you know, being a real innovator in just this whole, you know, various technology fields. Sort of in line with that then, can you provide your past career highlights and valuable leadership and career lessons for success that you wish to share with the audience?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that, Stephen. So one of the more interesting projects I was involved with was a very large hyperbaric chamber that we designed and built for the Ford Motor Company. That was a fascinating project, and it allowed that company to test their vehicles in atmospheric and altitude conditions that could simulate everything from the desert to the top of the Rocky Mountains in a blinding snowstorm right there in Dearborn, rather than traveling to all these various locations. And, you know, sometimes they had to take these vehicles to different places in the world to get the test data. And of course, that's very seasonal dependent, and it's very difficult for them to collect that data. Now they have the capabilities right there in their backyard. And that was a very rewarding and fun project to work on. Another one was the Magellan Telescope, the largest optical telescope in the southern hemisphere. That one has a primary mirror that's over 20 feet in diameter. The entire structure was a quarter of a million pounds of precisely controlled rotating steel and glass. Really fascinating project, and a lot of fun, a great team to work on. It's something that you feel like you're kind of contributing to science and helping the astronomers do much better research. And then, you know, while I was working for those companies, I was lucky to be able to help them start up a couple of independent branch offices. And I guess as a result of those experiences, the first companies I worked for, Ballard, they have rehired me to start up their U.S. operations. That turned out to be a real wild ride, I would say. Yeah, this was in the mid-1990s. Everything high-tech was hot, and Ballard, of course, was developing fuel cell technology, which was one of the hottest of the hot technologies. It was really something. We did a joint venture with Ford and Mercedes, and together with those companies, we achieved the proof-of-concept milestone for hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. We formed the California Fuel Cell Partnership, where all the world's leading automotive OEMs and energy companies, together with government agencies, worked collaboratively to really demonstrate the viability of fuel cell vehicles. And it's really quite interesting that the technology developed by the members of the California Fuel Cell Partnership was highlighted in President Bush's fuel cell economy roadmap that was in his State of the Union address back in the, I think, 2002 or 2003 State of Union address. That was somewhat rewarding, I would say, and kind of fun to be part of all that. Obviously, we didn't do the presentation for him, or we didn't prepare the speech, but just to be referenced in the speech was really something. And then in 2001, Ballard had this market cap in the billions, and they had all kinds of cash on hand from various financing on the NASDAQ exchange, and they purchased that joint venture back from the OEMs, the automotive OEMs that were in the partnership with us, for around $400 million. So generally speaking, I'd say the whole thing was quite a good success. And then from those experiences, I think the most important lessons to pass on to people would be to always follow a customer-focused philosophy. I keep coming back to that over and over again, that you really have to focus on the customer. And people often say, well, I don't have a customer, or I'm not in sales, so I never see the customer. And I always say back to them is that really everyone has a customer. When you're an accountant or an engineer, regardless of what role you have, there's always someone else that you're really providing that work or that service for. And it's just so important to clearly understand what that someone else is really requiring from you. So it's really important to listen and to ask the right questions to get a very clear picture of those requirements. And when you do that, I think you're much better prepared and your product will be much better as a result as well. And I think related to customer focus is very clear and effective communications. And here I would just point out that it's very important to be very careful when you make assumptions in communications. I find more and more that making assumptions is often the root cause of communication breakdowns. I know that for me personally. I've been working on that a lot lately, that you sometimes get busy and you just tend to make an assumption that other person knows this or that. But these days I make it a priority to take that extra time to pick up the phone or whatever it takes to get the extra information so that I can remove those assumptions. I think that the assumption process is very dangerous in communication.
And it's interesting, you know, you're sort of this lesson about customer focus, and I guess that's key to success and communications as well, and especially amongst technology people. Sometimes people are early in their careers and they have a technology focus, may not realize the benefit, effect of communications and care with assumptions and so on. So moving on then, what specific attributes contributed to your success?
I would say the most important one is what I call effectiveness, and that's simply getting the right things done rather than getting things done right. And I have to say that's not always easy. The perfectionist in me always wants to take more time on tasks and make sure that they're done just right. However, I guess I'm fortunate that the pragmatist in me always wins out, and typically I'm able to focus on getting the highest priority items done and make sure that they're done with the best quality in the available time and not lose track of time. Second, I would say is this customer focus that's somehow hardwired into me. I'm fortunate to have good customer skills and I'm very comfortable in the selling process. Just a few words about the selling process. People often think that selling is about talking and persuasion. In my opinion, the other half of communications, which is listening, and in particular listening after you've asked the right questions, is really the most important part of the selling process. And I always encourage people that are interested or getting started in the area in sales and marketing is to make sure that you keep track of the interaction with the customer and try to see who's asking the most questions. And I think you'll always find that the party that asks the most questions, or at least asks the most good questions, is really in control of that conversation and is in a much better position to ultimately win the sale.
Well, it's interesting, those tips about making sure that you stay on priorities and avoiding perfection paralysis. I guess that's what I would call it. And this whole idea of customer focus and really listening. Now, can you profile your current roles and projects, and then what you want to accomplish, and then the value that you deliver to your stakeholders?
Today, I'm happy to be involved with an organization called Connect. It's a San Diego-based organization that has been established to help mentor new entrepreneurs as they start up their businesses. I have to say it's very rewarding to be a volunteer in this group. You get a great chance to feel you're giving back some of these lessons learned to these new entrepreneurs and help them learn from your mistakes. I mean, that's what it's all about. I mean, these guys are just getting started out, and you have two choices. You can do it on your own and make the mistakes and learn from those, or you have the opportunity to tap into some experienced people who've made those mistakes and learned from them and can pass on a lesson. So that's, for me, the most valuable thing there is to help those entrepreneurs get started. And in parallel, I'm also an active member of Tech Coast Angels, which is a Southern California-based angel investment organization that funds early-stage ventures.
So can you then talk more about Tech Coast Angels?
Sure. TCA, as we call it, is the largest angel investment group in North America. The members have invested over $100 million in early stage ventures. Those companies, through their follow-on investments, either from venture capital firms or strategic partners, have raised over $1 billion. We have hundreds of members. More than half of them are actually seasoned entrepreneurs themselves. So as a result, the companies in Southern California that engage TCA have access to capital, and I would say equally importantly, they have access to valuable advice from people that have gone through the startup experience themselves. It's a really great organization.
Because of your involvement with TCA, then what are the major challenges in being an angel investor, and how can they be resolved?
Yeah, that's a really good question. First and foremost, these are very early stage companies. They typically don't have validation from customers where people are actually buying their products and you can, you know, measure their progress through revenues. As a result, they're very risky. When I first started with the angel investing, I was doing it independently, and in hindsight, I would say clearly I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. The the due diligence process is the key to a successful investment and to trying to remove as much risk as possible. And there it's so much more effective when you can leverage the wisdom of crowds, and that's what we do at TCA. That's the benefit of having this organization of many members that have diverse backgrounds and lots of great experience. It's very helpful to help reduce the risk, but obviously you never reduce all the risk. It is still a risky investment. Another challenge is a kind of funding gap that has come up in the venture space. So angel investors are typically pretty good at funding deals in the range of a half a million to maybe up to $1.5 million. As it turns out these days, for a number of reasons, VC firms are concentrating on larger deals, more like larger and I would say later stage deals, more like $5 million. So as a result, if we invest, say, $700,000 in an early stage company that is going to need some follow-on financing of, say, $2 or $3 million, in today's market, that follow-on financing is really not very easy to get. And as a result, what we're trying to do to fill this gap in the angel community is to syndicate with other angel groups from other regions so that we can pool our money and get to these larger investments to do that intermediate type of financing.
In terms of being an angel investor, what sort of percentage would you advise potential angel investors to sort of put at risk in being involved in angel investing?
That's very much an individual choice, I would say. But just thinking off the top here, you know, I think something in the range of 10 to 20% at the most, I would say, of a person's net worth maybe could be deployed in this high-risk space. And I'm a little bit conservative, so I'd be at the lower end of that scale.
You know, you've been doing this a long time. You're internationally renowned as an innovator, as an entrepreneur. So you would have a great idea about what are the mistakes made by startups and entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I do have some experience there and some background, and in my opinion, I would say the biggest mistake that new entrepreneurs in particular make is not seeking advice, and then maybe even worse is not listening once they have actually solicited the advice. One of the most important attributes that we look for when we search and due diligence these investments is the coachability of the founders and the management team. At the risk of sounding arrogant, the angel investors can add as much value through their knowledge as they can through their money. So full circle on that one. I think it's just very important for those entrepreneurs to listen and to proactively go out there and seek that advice. Second mistake I would say is the lack of focus. There's really two parts here. As I mentioned before, it's really critical to focus on the customer. In my opinion, if the entrepreneur tries to push his technology into the marketplace without first engaging customers and getting their requirements and driving those requirements into the product development process, they'll have a pretty low probability of success. And the second part of focus is trying to do too much with too little. Resources are always very limited in these early stage startups, so it's very important to be focused. Having said that, you know, the only thing that's really certain in a startup is that things will change. So the other part of focus here is a balance, I would say, between focus and agility. And then I guess the other common mistake that we see is those founders that sell shares in their early stage companies to friends and families, and typically what happens there is they get together and they have some wonderful conversations and everything's great. This is going to be the next big thing. And as a result, they come up with a valuation for the business that's frankly, a little bit unrealistic, or maybe too optimistic is a better way to say it. And sadly, what happens in that case is when the founders then go for their angel financing or venture financing, one of two things happen. Either the original investors have their investment diminished as a result of the new and more realistic valuation, or the deal just doesn't go through. So to avoid that one, there's good news. There's a very simple solution there, is that the founders should always do their early stage friends and family financing with a loan that can be converted to stock at a later date once the valuation is set by the more experienced investment community.
So let's say there's people in the audience who are, you know, been in the technology industry for some time. They have an innovative idea they've been working on. They've got some kind of a product perhaps already and sort of a beta stage, and they're saying, gee, I want to do a startup. I want to be an entrepreneur. Where do they go to get help in terms of investment?
Well, that's a little bit location-based, and I would say in Southern California, the entrepreneurs are very lucky to be in this region because there's a great infrastructure set up here. I mentioned the Connect organization. They have a very robust program in place that helps early-stage investors. It's called Springboard, and you're assigned a group of mentors with a marketing background, a finance background, and overall kind of leadership background that work with you for many hours, literally, to help you define your strategic plan, to help you develop a financing plan, your go-to-market strategy, literally even help, you know, to prepare investor presentations. So that's a really great organization. And I assume that other places actually, Connect is actually diversifying, growing, and spreading. So I think we now have an organization in New York as well. Presumably the group will grow more. So, but I imagine there's those type of, help and mentoring organizations in other regions. I just advise people to, if that kind of service is available, to jump in with both feet as quickly as possible. It's really an invaluable service that I would highly recommend people look for that type of support in the very early stages.
You know, Rick, you have the finger on the pulse of investment in North America, but also worldwide. So what are the biggest opportunities in investment, and how can they be actioned?
Well, I've spent most of my career in clean tech, so I'm pretty biased. I happen to believe that represents one of the biggest opportunities. You know, there's far too many things going on in that space to cover here, but just name a couple quickly. If someone can make improvements in battery energy density and also battery cost, that would certainly speed the adoption of electric vehicles. And secondly, there's some opportunities for very large-scale energy storage technologies, and those will enable a wider use of wind and solar power. So there's some interesting things going on in those fields. Those are, you know, typically not angel investments. So I think the capital that's required is usually quite enormous for those larger type of projects. So I personally believe there's an important role for the government in financing these technologies. Fortunately, here in the States, we have the Department of Energy and other agencies that have been actively involved. Back to our discussion earlier about China, it's interesting to note that various reports show the Chinese government is investing much more than the U.S. government is in this field of clean tech today.
Are there any specific projects that you're working on that you'd like to sort of give some exposure to?
I'm actually I'm a bit cautious there because some of them are very early stage, and we haven't finished the investments in some of these companies. So until the investments are in place, we should probably defer that perhaps to our next conversation, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. Now, can you provide your global perspective on innovation and investment trends?
Okay. I don't want to sound like a broken record here, but it's pretty clear that clean tech is a global trend. Another area I would say is healthcare. We see an awful lot of very exciting things coming to TCA in this field that can increase the effectiveness and reduce the cost in the healthcare space.
And I guess this kind of leads to this next question, where there isn't really any boundaries. And what are your five top predictions of future trends and their implications and opportunities? Now, you already talked about clean tech and healthcare. What are some more?
Well, just to to expand a little bit more on healthcare, if I can, I recently saw a really amazing presentation from Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong. He's a MD, a surgeon, a researcher, and a really accomplished entrepreneur. And it's fascinating to see how he's taking this problem on at the system level. He has advanced technologies in play that can break down the barriers between the knowledge that's available and the patients that need the treatment and the treatments themselves. His focus is, from my experience, unique, as he's really working on prevention and payment for health rather than payment for services that are sometimes just wastefully rendered. He has a number of really interesting pilot projects that are already validating his concepts. And I have to say, I came away from that particular presentation with a real feeling of hope that the healthcare challenges that we're facing can be resolved. I'd like to suggest that everybody follows his progress. He's really an amazing guy, and one of the vehicles that he has is a program called All About Advanced Health Project, and he has a website that's easily searchable under that name. And I think that that was really heartwarming and uplifting to see that there's a great opportunity there to really make a difference. We talked a little bit about China here, and that's obviously another interesting trend. I would say that China should be able to continue to outpace the growth of the rest of the world. There are a number of big questions out there regarding the sustainability of their growth. I would say, you know, it's a real estate bubble that's problematic, and there's a growing wealth gap that kind of make you wonder. However, you just have to come back to basic economics and the three prerequisites for growth, namely you need lots of people, you need lots of ideas, you need lots of capital. All of those are in bountiful supply in China. And furthermore, I would say that their central planning feature of their government really enables them to address those problems as they arise rather quickly. So, yeah, I'm pretty bullish on China. I believe that their growth will continue to grow despite some of those challenges. And then I remain optimistic as well that clean tech will continue to make an impact on climate change. However, there's economics and politics that make it pretty hard to predict the rate of change. But hopefully, politicians will eventually see the light and implement some actually very simple ideas that would provide funds for advancing these technologies. For example, a modest gasoline tax could make a huge difference. There was another thing we had in California here as a ballot initiative, maybe it was around 5 years ago, that would have raised literally billions of dollars for R&D here in California on clean technologies. That was a simple tax on the oil that was being pumped from the ground here in California that would have been diverted to R&D in this field. That's really disappointing that one didn't pass, but there's those kind of simple ideas that could help make a big difference. Of course, everybody's talking about a carbon tax that would be effective. It could be implemented globally. I'm a little doubtful that will happen. A lot of differences between the developed and the developing and the undeveloped countries. I think it might not happen quickly to this carbon tax. This carbon tax idea, but I'm still optimistic that the overall global competitiveness will ultimately drive investments that's required to speed up the development of clean technologies. There's another interesting area that I've recently been made aware of. It's it's the field of mindfulness-based stress reduction. Now it's truly amazing today that people are productive as they are when you think about all the challenges they have. There's, a middle-aged person today might, for example, have emotional and financial issues with their aging parents and their children in school. They're having to navigate, challenges with the economic situation and think about their retirement accounts. All of that stuff is going on before they even walk into the door of the company. And, of course, they're interacting with their colleagues that have all those own challenges themselves. So at the end of the day, it's really not surprising that we have these problematic interpersonal interactions that ultimately impact productivity. A few years ago, I met someone that was doing her PhD in this field, and she shared with me some of the research that she's doing in real-world situations where she's actually working with one of the largest high-tech companies in the Bay Area. And the data was very compelling. You could very clearly see that productivity was improved by using this mindfulness-based stress reduction program. I've done a little reading in the field, and I've tried to implement some of the techniques myself in my own personal life, and it's pretty impressive how you can maintain a level of calmness even in very difficult situations. And I really believe that that kind of technique can help companies improve their productivity in these difficult times. And I'll certainly be looking for opportunities to implement that in the next startup that I get involved with. Hopefully next time we talk, I'll have some firsthand data that I can share with you.
How about this whole idea of U.S. venture financing and American Ingenuity? Do you have any sort of thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one, too. I've been fortunate to have done business in various parts of the world, in Europe and Asia in particular. And the one thing that I think really differentiates the American culture is a term that I would say is resilience. And an example of that was around the time of 9/11, I was in the joint venture with Mercedes, and the German folks from Mercedes that we worked with were often here for various meetings, and I still remember their remarks very clearly. How they said, they were impressed with how strong and positive the Americans were able to stay very strong and positive in that very terrible time. And it was interesting to hear them comment that they thought that Germans and other Europeans would not have been so resilient at such a terrible time. And then I share a long history of life in Canada and the United States. I grew up in Canada, and I've done business both in Canada and here in the United States. More or less, half my time in each country. So I know both cultures very well. And for me, it's fascinating that, even though, we have this pretty bad economic recession, there's all these mortgages that are underwater. Virtually every person has a family member or a friend that's unemployed. Nevertheless, the people remain fundamentally optimistic and very rarely complain. On the flip side, I can remember, far less serious recessions when I was in Canada, and it's very common that on a day-to-day conversation, people would be complaining and grumbling about the situation. It's not that Canadians are pessimistic, but they just don't maintain that degree of optimistic outlook when things get tough. It's something, I think, quite unique to the American culture. And I would say that cultural differentiation combined with the very strong entrepreneurial infrastructure here really has enabled the Canadian in me to maintain optimistic about the economic future. And that infrastructure includes things like world-leading universities and other institutions that are churning out great ideas on a regular basis. Of course, the very strong angel and venture financing community that can nurture those new ideas. And then, of course, there's very well-established and fair laws in place that can protect IP and provide a level playing field, and there, as a result, the entrepreneurs and investors have confidence that they have some confidence that their investments will be somewhat protected, and they can take some risks. And speaking of risks, I'd say that's another area that really differentiates the U.S. Culture. Risk taking here, of course, is encouraged. Many entrepreneurs fail in their ventures. They dust themselves off. They get up again. They apply the lessons learned from that experience, and in many cases, go on to achieve great success. On the flip side, in many other cultures, failure is a one strike and you're out situation. And you can imagine how that difference in how risk is taken really drives a more of a growth environment for early stage companies.
Those are some really interesting thoughts. So kind of brings to mind then for yourself personally, where do you want to see yourself in 5 years or 10 years or let's say 100 years from now when we go to Wikipedia and we look up Rick Cooper? What do you want to be said about you and your life and what you contributed?
That's a great question. And I've been very fortunate over the last couple of years to have been able to sort of take a step back from day-to-day hands-on heavy lifting in the entrepreneurial sector and focus more on these angel investment and volunteer activities. And it's been very rewarding and informative and helpful to be able to take a bigger picture look and take some time to think about what you really want to do. And it's interesting. I thought I would be comfortable and I'd be really working mostly in this investment activity and volunteer stuff for maybe the rest of my life. However, what I've learned is that it's just not the same as being in the trenches, you know, negotiating those deals, building those teams, you know, building corporate cultures, hiring people, getting people jobs. All those things are just so much more exciting than the bigger picture, sitting back and advising and helping. I've concluded that I'm just so much more happy to be involved intimately in the entrepreneurial activity. So I've currently decided to look for opportunities. I still remain very passionate about clean tech, and I'm hopeful that sometime this year I'll be working closely with a clean tech company in an executive role, helping them grow their business.
I see. So you really are a lifelong entrepreneur.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought I had kicked the habit, but I was wrong. I really do enjoy it, and look forward to getting back into it.
We've talked about a lot of different sort of areas, and if there's people in the audience looking again for more information, what are your top recommended resources and why?
Well, in this field of entrepreneurial endeavors and angel investing, the best resource that I've come across is a book by a guy named David Berkus. His book is Berkonomics, and he's a very experienced, successful entrepreneur and angel investor. He has all kinds of very valuable and practical lessons that are written in a clear and very concise way. It's not, you know, theoretical. It's not a bunch of buzzwords like some of these business books. It's just a really pragmatic, fact-based book that has all kinds of real-world experiences that make for some very interesting reading. So I think that's a must-read for anybody that's interested in this entrepreneurial activities. And then for me personally, I like to stay abreast of developments in the clean tech space, and I find the blog, which is called Green Tech Media, to be the best source in this space. Eric Wessoff and Mike Canellos are very well connected and very well respected in this field. As a result, they get some great insights into what's really going on in the startup community in clean tech.
Is there a book in your future or some kind of media outlet?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I doubt it. I guess if I'm going to be getting back into the entrepreneurial activity, you get pretty busy when you're in that field. But maybe in the second phase of my next semi-retirement, I'll take some time to do that. That's a good suggestion.
Now, because you travel the world, you're involved with so many different kinds of people worldwide and with different and diverse backgrounds. You must have some interesting stories to share from your work, maybe something surprising or unexpected, amazing. Can you illustrate some of these to the audience?
Sure. The one that comes to mind, I touched on this earlier, but it just sticks with me as, you know, as someone that that grew up in Canada, you know, always revered and kind of respected the American culture, and I'm fortunate to be working down here, but to have, you know, kind of lived the dream here and gone to the point where you've, you know, been a pioneer in a field, working on some technology that can help improve society and make a difference. But then to have that technology to be featured in a president's State of the Union address, I have to say that's the one thing that really kind of sticks with me. It's very rewarding to have been one of the pioneers working in that field. So far, the fuel cell technology has not been commercialized, but very proud that, you know, many of the things that we worked on have paved the way for the rebirth of electric vehicles, which, of course, are now being commercialized. And clearly, electric vehicles are going to be a big part of the future of transportation. And I guess another one that comes to mind for me is how I've, you know, personally been affected, and I would say transformed when it comes to China. I can still remember my first trip there 5 or 6 years ago. And even though, you know, I've traveled around the world and I like to think I'm myself as an open-minded person, I can honestly say that I was literally paranoid to go to the communist country for the first time. It's just a remarkable transformation when I think about it over a fairly short period of time. I've since come to learn that there's nothing to be afraid of there and actually lots to admire. It is still communist, of course, but from my experience in the day-to-day business interactions, those transactions are very free. And actually, I would say that China has a very vibrant form of capitalism going on that in many ways is more capitalistic than some of the Western world. Of course, they have a history and a culture that's truly fascinating. The people are very warm and friendly. I find the language very intimidating, but I would say that I would seriously consider living in China. It's a really remarkable place.
That's kind of interesting, this whole aspect of China. So it kind of brings to mind this idea that, you know, China has what, 2.65 trillion in currency reserve surplus. I think they hold over $1 trillion, something like $1.5 trillion in US debt in some fashion. They are number one in supercomputing. In 2011, they'll actually overcome the US in patent filings per year. And the conference board out in New York, I believe they said by 2012, China will overtake the U.S. and GDP, that is PPP GDP. And then you have the OECD coming out with a report on education saying that they're going to, or I shouldn't say they're going to, they've already surpassed the world in terms of educational standards in some ways, in terms of rankings of cities. In fact, far above the traditional top spots held by the Netherlands, let's say, or Japan. And then you have this, you know, phenomenal economic growth of, what, 8-9%, and now it's going to probably go into double digits and has been in double digits before, and it's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And then the opening up of their financial markets late in, I guess, in December or late in 2010, and then the opening up of some aspects of the healthcare market. And this tremendous migration, I guess, of what, 350 million into new megacities in China. And it's, and the list just goes on and on and on. What does this mean to America?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And you know, first and foremost, I think, you know, the world has to get recalibrated here. I came away from that last trip particularly having a chance to see the infrastructure around the country and not just the big cities, as I'd only seen before, with a feeling that you really can't call China a developing country anymore. I mean, I haven't seen the entire country, so there's probably some areas that still are developing, but the significant portion where the largest population bases are, clearly very developed country, and in some cases, you know, more developed. I mean, just look at high-speed rail. I mean, we're still struggling with the concept of high-speed rail here, and, you know, they're installing it in a big way. And have already installed it. So yeah, it's just I think it, for me, there's a nomenclature here thing that has to be adjusted fairly soon. And you know, I believe that, you know, China will be the dominant power in this century. It's just a matter of time. I talked earlier about the powerful entrepreneurial environment here in the United States, and I still remain pretty bullish on that. And I think that, you know, the U.S. will be a force to reckon with for quite some time. But there's no doubt that China is on a trajectory to become the economic powerhouse in the world in this century. It's just a little bit hard to predict exactly when.
Well, you know, if you look at the GDP, sort of the nominal GDP rankings of the world right now, to at this moment, USA is number one. You know, it's about a $14 trillion economy, but China's now number two, and they overtook Japan last year, followed by Germany and then Brazil. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that those are now the top five countries in just, you know, general output, and it's interesting that China now is in the number two ranking. Another interesting part is this whole education aspect, and it kind of concerns me in the West, because I'm formerly an education or an educator in the West, and that is that, you know, China's graduating something like 1 million graduates in engineering and science per year, and that's contrasted to, let's say, 60,000 in the U.S. You know, what does that mean if we don't put more money into our educational infrastructure here in the West? And I know, for example, Shanghai has, what, 1 million students entering college per year, something like that. I mean, how do you compete with those numbers?
Yeah, I think that the numbers are against us here, us being, you know, the North American and, say, the Western world. At the end of the day, the numbers are against us. We talked earlier about the basic economics, what's required for growth. You need people and ideas and capital. And the simple fact is that, you know, people are a limiting resource in most of the world. But China, is, as it's transforming into this developed country, has got not an endless supply of people, obviously, but, you know, for some decades now, they've got a very solid supply of people. And they're very clever people, so the idea component, they are always generating all kinds of great ideas. And as you talked about earlier, they're sitting on gobs of capital right now. So they have all of the ingredients for baking the perfect economic growth cake, and they're also, I find it interesting when you compare governments and the makeup of the governments. I haven't seen the exact numbers, but the majority of people in government in China are typically scientists and engineers, and of course the majority here are lawyers. Now, I know lots of lawyers, and I'm married to a lawyer, so there's lots of good lawyers out there, but I'm also, maybe I'm biased as an engineer, but it feels to me like you want to plan infrastructure and you want to plan development, perhaps an engineer or a scientist is going to have the better background for that compared to a lawyer. So yeah, I think there's a lot of things in play here, including the basic fundamentals of the way the government is made up that bode very well for China.
Rick, you have this amazing background. You're recognized internationally, and you know the audience would be interested in, you know, in terms of your life experiences, what kind of career tips could you provide to the audience? You know, what would be the tips and the reasons behind them?
I come back to this all the time, and we've talked about it a little bit already, but I really think it's important to stress that you really always have to ask the customer what they really want before you start your work. And at the same time, as I mentioned, you know, avoid those assumptions wherever possible. You know, by doing this, I'm confident from my own experience that the company's product, or if it's not the product that's shipped out the door, if it's the worker's product that goes on to their internal customer, those people that do that extra work to go out there and find out what those customer requirements are in a very detailed way will always be able to make a better product. I'd say as well, you know, it's really important to take your job seriously. Of course, you have to work really hard to be successful, but always be mindful of that work and life enjoyment balance. You have to maintain that work-life balance to remain overall health. I've been a big proponent of regular and frequent exercise. That's one piece of advice I always like to pass on to people. I find that it clears the mind, it allows you to focus. If you're able to do some cardiovascular work to help, there's all kinds of research out there that shows that it's very not only helpful for your physiological state, but also for your mind. And I think I would highly recommend people again maintain a balance and keep maintain a healthy lifestyle as a priority in their day-to-day lives.
You know, those are some really great tips, and now we're down to our last few questions here. I come from the computing industry, so I want to see your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession like medicine and law or engineering with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, globally recognized credentials, and more. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a really interesting question. I'm a user of those computers and IT services for quite some time now. And as you mentioned, that requirement for ethics and standards, it's quite interesting, particularly when you think about those developers of software and computers that are used for personal financial information, for example. You know, as someone that does all kinds of transactions online these days, I certainly hope that those folks are working to those kinds of high standards. And honestly, I don't know what kind of standards there are today. I think when you talk about that on a global basis, I imagine that it might be rather difficult to develop a global credential. Perhaps that ends up being something like a carbon tax, where people can see that it's beneficial, but the actual realization on a global scale could be very difficult. So maybe those type of standards are more on a country by country basis. Ultimately, it would be great if they could be global. But yeah, it dawned on me as you were talking about that, the importance of it, particularly for some of this very sensitive information. I mean, it could be very easy to have all kinds of disruptions in the world if some of these products were not developed in the most ethical way. So I think it's a great idea, and I hope it does catch on, and there's a capability to do it on a global basis. But just thinking about it from somewhat of an outsider's perspective, it might end up being something that's more regional than global.
Well, Rick, we're down to our very last question, and this is where I sort of turn the tables. You know, I'm thinking I must have missed something. So what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers if we were to turn the tables?
Okay, yeah. I guess I'd like to say a couple of things that I'd say are the most important things for people to consider when they want to start doing business internationally. And I'd say first and foremost is to be patient. You know, there's cultural differences. Obviously, there's communication challenges that just mean that fundamentally everything is going to take longer. And, you know, actually in certain countries, you know, for example, Japan, even if you, you know, do business in Japan and you're Japanese amongst Japanese, where the cultural differences aren't there and the communication challenges aren't there, they're one-on-one with each other, things just take longer there since, you know, their culture is more of a consensus-based culture. So the basic thing here is that there's going to be a lot of things different, and you have to be mindful of that. And most importantly, you need to be ready to invest more time than most people ever expect when you think about doing business internationally. I guess secondly, in the area of international business is this concept of agility or flexibility. It's just really important to respect the differences. If people go in with a, you know, very, you know, strong, you know, this is the way we do it, therefore this is the way it has to be done in this deal kind of mentality, it's really, I wouldn't say it's impossible to have success, but it's by far more difficult than if you are open-minded and flexible. You know, there's some examples here, some at the very basic level. If you look at the way negotiators work in North America, they're very much focused on that contract. You know, certainly there's some niceties, and, you know, you'll have some, you know, various dinners and other social interactions with the other party's negotiators. But, you know, everybody is really focused on that contract. It's all about getting the document just right. However, if you think about business in China, they're much, much more focused on that relationship. And, you know, in some cases, you know, they would prefer to do, and they do it often amongst themselves, they do business there without a contract. There's literally, you know, lots of handshake deals that are done in China. And for them, it's all about the relationship, or it's much more about the relationship than it is the actual contract. And you have to be mindful and very respectful of those differences and be able to adjust your typical approach to be successful in international transactions.
I can see that whole concept of contracts would be difficult, though, for Americans, right?
Oh, and I can honestly say, for me personally, it was a very difficult adjustment. You know, you know that, you know, you got to have that contract. You've been doing these deals for a long time in your career, and, you know, the deal is the most important thing, and the contract is, you know, it's solid. And we talked about the, you know, the legal system here before and how it provides that kind of trust and that support for business to be done. But yeah, things are just different there. They just don't value that contract anywhere near the level that we do here. And there's an interesting saying that a few of my colleagues have shared with me over the years that, in China, the negotiation starts after you sign the contract. Because, as I said, those contracts are important but not as meaningful as they are for us. So things are almost certainly going to change after you do the contract, and that's just the way they are over there. And you have to be willing to accept that and be flexible.
Well, those are some just great insights, and I know that some people in the West, when they hear that, they'll be shocked, right?
Yeah, and it was literally very challenging for me to make that adjustment as well. It's something like, oh my goodness, how you know, what do you mean the contract is going to change after we do the contract? It's all about the contract. But no, you learn that, you know, that's the way they do it, and as long as you know they respect the contract, they don't you know, it's not a meaningless document. It's a starting point, but everything certainly will change after the contract is in place.
Rick, you are an historical figure. You know, you've made significant contributions which have global impact, and this will continue for your entire career, for your entire life, because you're committed to making these continued contributions. And I thank you for coming in to do this interview and sharing your time and wisdom with our audience, and it's very much appreciated.
Oh, you're very welcome, Stephen. I'm very happy that we met on that trip to China, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Rick Cooper, top-ranking, internationally known entrepreneur, innovator, executive, and investor.